This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network. Visit us at fmpods.com.
When I was a kid growing up in Jersey, anybody who was a hoot or really funny or something, we'd call them a riot. Ladies and gents, this guy's a riot in more ways than one. Bob Dylan.
This is Pod Dylan, a show that celebrates the work of Bob Dylan, one film at a time, part of the FM Podcast Network. I'm your host of Freewheeling, Rob Kelly, and joining us once again to talk about the 2003 movie Masked and Anonymous is my pal and fellow podcast host, Jason MD. Hi, Jason. Welcome back.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for having me on again.
Of course, there was no way I was going to wrap up Pod Dylan without having you clock in at least one more appearance. But I will say, you have been pitching this discussion with me for a long time, and I have been putting it off. But I realized I could deny you no longer now that this is your last appearance on Pod Dylan. Let's just put an asterisk for now. The show, who knows what the future might bring, but for now, this is your final appearance on the show. So let's talk about Masked and Anonymous. Why?
Okay.
Why did you want to talk about this movie so much?
Because it's such a fab movie, man. It's an uneasy puzzle to solve, Rob Kelly. This movie is not for sissies. It's unique, isn't it? I don't think there's anything else like it. I was racking my brains today trying to think if there's anything quite like it, and I couldn't think of anything. The closest I could get to is Paul McCartney's train wreck of a movie, Give My Regards to Broad Street. Have you ever seen that?
I saw it once decades ago. Like, I saw it back when I worked at a video store, so I have no memory of it at all.
Yeah, it's a jungle of baloney. Let me just to, let's leave it at that. And I also was thinking, though, that there's a connection, I think, between Bob Dylan's film career, such as it is, and Prince's film career, the other genius from Minnesota. two guys who their first movies were critically lauded and quite successful, but crucially, I think, made by other people, right? In Prince's case, that's Purple Rain. And for Dylan, Don't Look Back, right? I think that might have bamboozled them both into thinking, well, okay, I'm a great musician and all that, but I can also make films. Clearly, people want to see me on the big screen. And it led mostly to disaster for both of them. I don't know if you've seen Prince's post Purple Rain movies, Under the Cherry Moon,
Don't think I have. I've seen Purple Rain, certainly, but
yeah, Purple Rain is pretty good, but Under the Cherry Moon has its moments, but it's a bit of a mess. And then Graffiti Bridge, which came out, I think that's early 90s. Is a total disaster. Don't Look Back, most people really like. How do you feel about Don't Look Back?
I mean, I certainly think it's a great movie. I don't revisit it a whole lot simply because I find Bob to be relatively kind of unpleasant in the movie. I know, and all credit to him for allowing himself to be shown like that. And so, and that's great seeing him at that point in his life and seeing him so up close. But I find it to be a little bit of an unpleasant watch. So it's not something I return to a whole lot.
I'd agree with you there. A bit of an unpleasant watch. He does come off as unpleasant, doesn't he? Sort of just arrogant and snotty and, I don't know, not as deep as he seems to think he is. What's a green door, man? But then... have you ever seen, what was the next one? Eat the Document, right? Which I've seen a bootleg of that. Have you ever seen that?
I saw that once again, like a bootleg a long, long time ago. I remember the version I saw was on VHS and it was such poor quality. It was like looking at the ice cube.
Me too.
So I was like, all right, this is not land. I have to revisit this at some other point. And I just haven't gotten around to it.
Right. And then have you seen Ronaldo and Clara?
Yes. Yes, I have. that's another one. That's another one that I saw on a bootleg VHS in the 90s, and it was such poor quality that it was just sort of like I'm squinting as to what is going on. And we got, all right, David Blues playing pinball. All right, we got that, and then we got to the concert stuff. I'm like, oh, this is great. And then it would go back to you know, John Baez playing Bob Dylan. And I just was sort of like, okay, I don't know. I don't know what this is. But I mean, I will say, I mean, not that it'll ever happen, but if some local theater got a print of it and played it, I would go in a heartbeat. I would love to see it with these tired eyes at this age, but just in a new perspective. I think it, at 24, whenever it was I saw it, I think I just was not in the headspace to really appreciate what's going on in that movie. And, you know, well, okay, I'm sorry. Go, continue. I don't want to interrupt you.
Okay. No, that's all right. Then, of course, Hearts of Fire, which I don't think it's great, but I like it a lot just because of Bob is so weird in it all the time. And then this, which, you know, he's just an actor in Hearts of Fire. This, he certainly had much more to do with. Do you know what the name of this film is in Japanese?
No.
Rob Kelly? It's Bob Dylan no Atama no Naka, which means inside Bob Dylan's head, right?
Wow, right on the line there.
Right on the money, man. So, I remember, I think I watched this on video cassette when it came out. I don't think it certainly didn't play anywhere near where I was living.
Okay.
I think I had to wait to order it from Amazon or whatever. And then, I remember watching it with my brother and we were in hysterics because we thought it was really, really funny, and invited a friend of ours over who, the famous Big Al Simpson, who was a big Dylan fan from Wales. And I was convinced he would hate it and he loved it too. So I thought, okay, there's something going on here. I'm not exactly sure what, and I still don't know what's going on here, but it's a fascinating artifact. And I thought it would be really fun to talk about it with you.
Well, okay. It's funny. This topic just came up a couple of days ago. I was doing another audio commentary for a Blu-ray release that's coming out for a 1967 horror comedy called Hillbillies in a Haunted House, which is, it's a real movie. Lon Chaney Jr.'s in it, Basil Rathbone. But the reason I bring it up is that it's this mixture of a country western jamboree movie with genuine country stars like Merle Haggard and Ferlin Husky, like playing their songs, like just they're not, you know, just straight ahead playing their music and then mixed in with this goofy ass horror plot. But part of the thing that I was commented on in the Blu-ray, which will be out later on in the summer, is like there's a couple scenes in that movie of Merle Haggard, right? And it's just him playing. And I was like, wow, it caught him right as he was beginning to take off. This is 67. So he was starting to get some hits, but he would not become the big name that he would later on become. And I was watching and I'm like, you know what? If you're a Merle Haggard fan, this is great. Right? Because you're seeing unadulterated footage of a guy you like from when he was in his, you know, his youth. And you don't, unless you go see him in concert a lot. And even then, unless you're right up on the stage, you don't get that. And I've talked about that with Bob about No Direction Home. You know, part of the great thing the great thing of that movie is the footage of Bob just talking. You don't get that a lot. And so, I saw this movie in the theater. I think I sat through it twice. I was in love with the idea of seeing Bob Dylan in this different context for such an extended period of time for so long, right? That was so cool, of just seeing him walk around and, you know, with his cowboy hat, and he's talking to Cheech Marin and he's talking to Tracy Walter at the hotel. And then he's interacting with the band. You know, the band is in this movie. But side note, man, Charlie Sexton is a smoke show in this movie. He looks yes. so good. I was like, you know, you kind of want to like follow him because he's so handsome. He looks, not that the other guys don't look great, but he looks like a movie star. And every time they kind of saunter off stage, you're like, oh, follow those guys. What's going on there? I enjoyed it for that reason. I will say I have now watched this movie, I think four separate stages in my life. I saw it when it came out. I saw it when it came to home video. I saw it again a bunch of years ago. And then, of course, I watched it again for the purposes of this. And I got to tell, and this is part of the reason I put you off, Jason, this episode, I just can't get on this movie's rhythm. I just can't do it. And because on the one hand, I hear what you're saying in that it is meant to be very funny in a sarcastic, very arch kind of way. And on, so I could see how people find it funny, right? And we could talk about all that stuff. But on the other hand, sometimes I watch it and did you ever watch 30 Rock? Did you ever watch that show?
No.
Okay. Do you know the premise of it at all? Are you familiar with it at all? Like, okay. It was Tina Fey and Alec Baldwin, and she plays the producer of a Saturday Night Live type comedy variety show. And Alec Baldwin was her hard right Republican boss, although he was Alec Baldwin, he's very sweet to her. And the whole kind of one of the comic veins that they tapped on the show was that she was this sort of well-meaning, you know, hardworking, well-meaning, idealized, liberal, and he was this conservative that was sort of mocking her the whole time. And of course, the whole show is written by Tina Fey and her writers, so you know it's like these are people of lefty politics writing lines for an arch right conservative, right? And so that was part of the gag of it, because, you know, Alec Baldwin is too. I was also very, very liberal. But there's a line in it where he, I'm sorry for going on this long diversion, but there's a line on it. There's a line in an episode where she talks about some well-meaning thing that she's doing, and he mocks her by saying, "Geez, Lemon, why don't we go down to the quad and play hacky sack and talk about apartheid?" And for years, Kelly and I use that phrase when we want to mock someone trying way too hard in any respect. We just say, "Why don't we go down to the quad and talk about apartheid?" And I feel like this movie sometimes is going down to the quad and talk about apartheid. Like, it's trying so hard to be edgy and cool and dark,
meaningful, and
like,
and meaningful, mysterious,
and above it all. And like, we're sneering at all these idiots that don't see the real truth, man. And that is something that I don't hear in Bob Dylan's music. I don't, even when he's doing that.
Right.
I don't get that whiff of pretension and trying too hard. And this movie, every time I watch it, I just go, I want to love it. I want to love it.
Yeah.
And I get people that do love it. Split Tooth Media had a great review of it, which I really did appreciate. And I can't argue with any of it. But every time I sit and watch it, I just go, this is just okay. You know, oh, he's playing Cold Iron's Bound. That's cool.
Play. And one of the mysteries of this movie, I think, is trying to sort of figure out for yourself how much of it are the Dylan bits and how much are the Larry Charles bits, right? You know, the origin story where Dylan at his famous boxing gym, right? Because he was into Jerry Lewis movies and wanted to make a slapstick series for HBO. Oh.
What a loss that we did not get that.
Yeah. So then, you know, they go for the meeting and so on. And then HBO says, sure, we'll do it. And then in the elevator when they're leaving, Dylan says, yeah, I don't want to do it anymore. It's too slapsticky. But Charles pushed ahead with it. So, and then Larry Charles said that when he first met with Dylan, you know, Dylan brought out this elaborate wizard box, and it was full of hotel stationery that he'd been scribbling on in Brazil and Norway and all over the place. And
imagine just that.
Lines of dialogue and names and so on. And said, I don't know what to do with this. And Larry Charles said, no, well, we string it together and make a story. So thinking about the movie today, I was thinking lots of the scenes work really well. Just the individual scenes work great. But they're not strung together in any coherent way, really. You know, like that bit where he's talking to you know, at the bus stop, where he comes in and he's leaning really weirdly, so his boot is pushing his trouser leg out, and hey, Prospero, that whole scene, it's terrific. It's only a couple minutes, but it works great. You know, are you ever gonna come back? I did come back. Oh, that scene also has one of my favorite lines in the movie, which is, you missed it, man. Two eagles just killed a pregnant rabbit. And Dylan goes, rabbit must have done something. Like, that's a wonderful line, you know? So just little, and then when he gets on the bus and, you know, is this bus going across the border? No, you're going the wrong way, sir.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Like, that little bit works terrific. And then when he's on the bus later, I forget the actor's name. I think
Giovanni Ribisi.
Yeah, that sequence is terrific too, right? Most of the John Goodman, when he's talking to Dylan in the trailer, and Dylan's sitting in the chair all weird with his legs up.
That I was funny. I was watching that scene, and my wife walked in from the other room. She goes, "Why is he sitting like that?" I was like,
Yeah.
"Yeah, he looks weird. His head looks weird.
Looks very weird.
The lens that Larry Charles was using is making it the screen bow out a little bit on the side. So yeah, Bob looks like he's got a giant head and tiny little stick legs.
Tiny,
It's very odd."
yes. Yeah. But little scenes work pretty well. When he's talking to the dictators, or the new dictator, played
Mickey Rourke.
by Mickey Rourke. Little scenes work well. That bit with Val Kilmer is terrific too. But they don't seem to connect in any particular way most of the time. You know, what is the plot of this movie, Rob? Can you tell me?
I mean, in the loosest sense, there's been a political revolution, and there have been people that are disaffected by that revolution, and the government, for some reason, wants to hold a benefit concert, I guess, to kind of mollify people and give the idea that they're doing something. And so they put together this concert. And as they mentioned, they can't get anybody big. They can't get McCartney. They can't get Springsteen. So they get Jack Fate, this washed up legendary figure who's been in jail for some reason. And then they spring him. And then, they pair him up with the Twist of Fate band, played by Bob's band. And we get to see some of that. And then it just kind of, I don't know, Bob just kind of walks around for a while. And then
Walks
eventually
around
they.
very stiffly and awkwardly. That's true. Yeah. And then he gets at the end, presumably, he's going back to jail, right? Nothing was revealed at all. Yeah. The concert doesn't even, what do they play? One song, I think,
Like one
right?
song, yeah.
And then, yeah. So, in the loosest way, that's the plot. But again, how much of that was in Dylan's wizard box and how much was Larry Charles? Nobody knows except for those two guys, I guess. So it's kind of weird. I get the sense that, and I saw an interview or read an interview with Larry Charles where he said, I wanted to make a movie that was like a Bob Dylan song. I wanted it to be mysterious and multi-layered and hard to figure out, like a puzzle, right? But that's how it feels to me, is somebody who's not Bob Dylan trying to do a Bob Dylan thing with Bob Dylan in it, which makes it even weirder, you know?
I
Yeah,
mean,
inside Dylan's head.
yeah. I mean, well, you mentioned John Goodman, and he's essential, I think, to this movie because he brings his typical John Goodman energy. And I mean that in nothing but complimentary ways. Like, he's always
Yes.
big and
Yeah.
bombastic, and he's playing a very Albert Grossman kind of figure, obviously. But I mean, the cast they assembled for this is truly like it's the hippest love boat you're ever going to see. I mean, it's,
Yeah.
Jeff Bridges, Penelope Cruz, we mentioned John Goodman, Jessica Lange, Luke Wilson, Angela Bassett, Stephen Bauer, Bruce Dern, Ed Harris, Val Kilmer, Cheech Marin, Chris Penn, Giovanni Ribisi, we mentioned Mickey Rourke, Christian Slater, the great actress Susan Tyrell is in this movie as she doesn't even get a line. She's the fortune teller. Fred Ward, I mean, good, and not to mention the band and stuff. So I mean, it's just an amazing group of people that they've collected. And as you said, in its center is Bob Dylan. And look, we've talked about this in other episodes. Bob can't act. He cannot act anymore. Now, maybe at some point he could act, but I think he has, at the age that he is in this movie, he's what, 72 when he made this movie? He has just ossified into a block of wood. And he can't even walk convincingly. When he walks out of the jail, he's like doing like, I'm walking. I'm walking, like he can't even. And it's just, I think he is someone that the minute the camera gets on him, he freezes up. And we talked about this, I forget, something related to the Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid movie, in that I think if he had worked with, look, when he worked with Sam Peckinpah, Peckinpah famously had so much other things to deal with on that movie. He just did not, and he didn't even really know who Bob Dylan was. He was only in that movie because Kris Kristofferson sort of vouched for him. Peckinpah did not have the time, or maybe even the inclination, to draw a performance out of Bob Dylan. He just didn't have it. And so Bob is this weird thing that shows up in the movie every so often, and he's utterly fascinating. I mean, he has movie star presence, off the charts level presence. The minute he's on screen, you're looking at him. And that's just what he is. But he never worked with a director that was able to pull a performance out of him. And actually, it's funny. This came up again on another audio commentary I did for a movie called Door to Door Maniac, which is the first movie Johnny Cash was in as an actor. And he's not good in the movie because the director famously apparently said, whatever you want to do, Johnny, is fine with me. That's not directing, you know, like you need, you know, and I think part of the reason somebody like a Frank Sinatra ended up becoming, I would say, as equally famous a movie star as he was a singer is because he worked with real directors. He tried to apply his craft and became, I'd say, in a lot of instances, really good, a really good actor. Bob never did that. And so he's working with Larry Charles, and it just Larry Charles just cannot get anything out of this guy. And so every time you cut back to him, he's being Bob Dylan, which is, again, if you're a Dylan fan, that's great to watch.
Yes.
But I mean, when he tries to supposedly cry thinking about the death of his dad, you're like, what are you? And then that makes me say, is the whole thing just a put on? Is it supposed to be just a giant joke? And then, but then I flip, then I flip back again and I say, well, if the whole thing's a joke, what am I sitting here for? Like, what, you know what I mean? Like, what if the whole thing's just a put on? To what end? Why, you know, and like you said, Larry Charles said he wanted it to be like a Bob Dylan song. I can appreciate that. But Bob Dylan songs at their most run 20 minutes, not an hour and 49. You know, it just gets like, now I will tell you, one of the, like the scene in the network's offices, right? Where we see their schedule up on the wall of the shows that are currently air on television in this world, that like that to me is hilarious. You look at the shows and there's like there's one called Slave Trade, another show is called Terror Tots, like that Terror made Tots. Me Terror Tots like that made me, and then there's a show called Joker Man and another show called It's All Right Ma, and like that genuinely made me laugh. Like I was like, oh okay, that like if the movie could be kind of that level funny of commenting on a thing but doing it in its own unique way. And then the movie to me never really, other than Goodman, never quite achieves that level of humor again. I don't know. Like I said, I hated the idea of your last appearance here on the show being one where I'm not totally on board with That's the thing okay, we're man. Talking about.
But hey, made it through Joey together. We can
we
get
did.
Through this.
It's again, I'm so glad that people get out of it what they get out of it. I really do. That's great. But I just, every time I watch it, I just feel like, all right, I am being excluded from the cool kids club. And the best of his music to me never has that feeling. It never, even when he's talking about something I don't understand, I never feel like I'm being pushed out because I'm not hip enough to understand this. And that, you know, that may be my own insecurities. You know, my own prejudices that I'm bringing to this thing of where, but it's the thing where no one in this movie talks like a real person. They all talk in little speeches. They all talk in little aphorisms and that's the style. But you just say, okay, well then what am I supposed to pick up when this movie is so clearly like Luke Wilson, right? Luke Wilson's in this movie. I love him in this movie. I always like Luke Wilson. I think he should have been a bigger star than he kind of turned out to be. I think he's great in this. I just love his warmth to it. I love the way he sort of dotes on Bob, his character. Like, that's really sweet. Jeff Bridges is sort of fun. It's nice to have Jeff Bridges and John Goodman together, the Big Lebowski reunion. Like, that's fun. But, like, the whole bit about Jeff Bridges' character being, you know, trying to, like, get answers out of Bob. Like, you're supposed to have all the answers, man.
Right.
And it's a little like, in 2003, is Bob Dylan still getting that? Is that still a thing on him? Is he still really under that pressure? In the 60s, yeah. But now, is that still a thing that's bothering him? That like, are people really coming to him for the answers to the universe in 2003?
Well, even in that Larry, I think it's on YouTube, the Larry Charles interview about this, where he's talking about the way Dylan deals with people. He said, because people would come up to him and go, you know, even while Larry Charles was there, so that was early 2000s, and ask him, you know, why'd you go electric, Bob? You know,
that's insane. That is insane that somebody does that. Yeah.
So I think that yes, he is still under that kind of pressure. It was a bit overblown, a bit overdone in the movie, I think. But I wanted to ask you, Rob, what is Jeff Bridges' character's name? Do you remember?
It's what's Tom Friend, isn't it?
Tom Friend. Okay. Mm-hmm. John Goodman's character.
Uncle Sweetheart.
That's right. Luke
Great
Wilson.
Names. These names are fantastic.
Luke Wilson's character.
Hold on, I'll look it up because I don't remember what his character's name was. Bobby Cupid.
Yes. See, there are, you know, again, I don't think the whole thing holds together necessarily, but I can take the little bits that I like, things like that, the great names. But back to what you're saying, well, you know, you're not with the cool kids or whatever. I don't know. I think part of that may be because this movie doesn't know what it's, I don't think the movie knows what it's trying to be. You know, if it really did come out of slapstick, there are some elements that are still slapsticky, I guess, that made it through, like that the man eating chicken, right? Yeah. That bit. Or the joke that Bobby Cupid tells Jack Fate. Do you remember that?
Oh, what's the joke?
What did the leopard at the poker game or something? I thought you was a cheetah.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
how did that not
like
end
that
up in 11 Theft Song?
Yeah, like exactly.
That was, yeah.
So little bits like that that are sort of openly slapsticky. But for me, the really funny parts are in the language and in the lines. Like after Val Kilmer's bonkers speech about animals and all that,
and
he pretends to kill the rabbit, and then John Goodman comes up to rescue Bob and goes, "What was that about?" And Bob goes, "The guy's into animals, I guess." You know? That kills me every time. When Goodman says to Jack Fate, Uncle Sweetheart says to Jack Fate, rather, you know, it'll be like the Civil War in Babylon. And just Dylan's reaction, Civil War in Babylon. That's great. When Penelope Cruz says, "What's bugging you, Tommy?" And he says, "What's bugging me? The absurdity of a lifetime of feudal labor. That's what's bugging me." That's another great line.
See, now when you say the lines, they're funny.
That could be my favorite one. My favorite one is when Mickey Rourke says, "Out of nowhere," and it doesn't make any sense, but it just clobbered me. "We're not just a couple of macho men from the flea market." What on earth?
I do enjoy Chris Penn and Christian Slater as the sort of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of this movie. Like they're just kind of like we cut to them and they're commenting on the action and then we cut away from them and stuff. I would imagine that if you are not a Bob Dylan fan, this movie has zero appeal for you. Like it's just a completely impenetrable wall other than getting to see all these big stars. I mean, you know, hey, if you ever want to see a movie where Jessica Lange rubs one out to a Bob Dylan song, this is your movie. You know, I mean, it's like, okay, where else you could have seen that in a movie? The bit about where she's listening on the radio where they said they've stuck a microphone down into the core of the earth and they're hearing the souls of people. Yeah. And you're hearing people scream like, Jesus, you know, like, oh my God, what a great idea. You know, that was that on a napkin? Was that on one of them from the Ramada Inn or something? What was that about?
Well, okay. Let me, if I may, just list a couple of things that I really like about this movie, the good stuff in it. You mentioned before, you know, that board with the TV shows and so on. The little Easter eggs for the fans. I like that stuff. That's fun. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you notice when the camera goes into the building and you can, you know, I guess it's the building where everything's happening, but you see the different people who are on different floors. Did you notice I think it's Dr. Benway, psychiatrist. And I believe that's a character from William Burroughs's Naked Lunch. Right?
Oh, I didn't notice that. Okay.
Again, yeah, I like the names. I like the look of it. I like the costumes. I like Dylan's cowboy outfits a lot. he looks great. The crying scene is not great, but what I like about that is Larry Charles on the commentary track said, Dylan showed up that day and said, "Okay, I want to cry in this scene," and they said, "Okay." So
that's a way to make a movie.
They waft it. Yeah, exactly. See, that's maybe part of the problem. Not only does the movie not know what it wants to be, I have a feeling that nobody was directing Bob. You know, they were, you know, everybody worked for scale, apparently, just to be in a movie with Bob Dylan. I have a feeling that Larry Charles wasn't going to yell at Bob and get him to not sit so crazy in the chair and, you know, don't walk like that, Bob. Don't do that. You know, I think it was sort of nobody was really in control. That's the sense I get. That's why it's so anarchic, maybe. But yeah, when he showed up and said, "I want to cry," so they did. Larry Charles says it's standard operating procedure. They wafted some kind of menthol concoction. That's what he calls it, a menthol concoction, into Bob's eyes, and Bob immediately went blind and had to be taken to the hospital.
Oh, God. Yeah. I wish I'd listened to this. I bought the Blu-ray and I meant to listen to the commentary, but I just ran out of time. So that's, Oh, wow. You don't want to blind your star while you're shooting your movie.
No. And I love the music. Not only the performances, which are really interesting and filmed in an interesting way, too, like right up close.
That stuff's great. I mean, that stuff's just great.
And that "I'll Remember You" is gorgeous. I really, really like that. And then, you know, the camera pans over and the drummer's playing a cardboard box. I don't think I've ever seen that before or since. Yeah. Right? It's very weird. There's lots of little weird things like that throughout. So all that stuff is great. Or also, again, lots of Bob's looks are terrific. When Jessica Lange's character says, you know, the seeds won't grow if you plant them on the carpet, he does this weird wince and turn away that the first time my brother and I watched it, we rewound that 5 or 10 times because we were just in hysterics because it's so funny. So I think all that stuff is really great. I like also the look of the film. I know it was shot on the cheap and in 3 weeks, right? And on the Larry Charles on the commentary track, you know, sort of hints at, well, just there wasn't enough money. That's why he's the preacher at the start. You know, that voice coming over.
Oh, is that Larry Charles at the beginning?
Okay, yeah, he said we just didn't have enough money to get somebody else. So I did it. You know, he would explain several shots and saying we had to do it this way because there was no money, you know, and we had to do it quick. So, but despite that, some of the sets are pretty cool too. Like that jail that Jack Fade is in.
Yeah, that underground jail. Yeah.
It's the old bear cage at the zoo in Los Angeles, apparently, which I thought was terrific, right? Like it just looks great. And knowing that makes the scene even better. And then, of course, Bob with his wig on that he likes so
love
much
that wig.
He wore
yeah,
it to
yeah.
Sundance, right?
Yeah.
And I like and today, actually, this is, I wasn't going to admit this, but I put the movie on my device and I went for a walk and I just listened to it, you know, because I'd watched it enough. I thought, I'm just going to listen to it. How does it sound? It's a very menacing soundscape, actually.
Yes.
And,
yes.
There's just in the background, there's constant sirens and sort of amplified loudspeaker voices giving commands and explosions and gunfire and so on. It's a very menacing film in a way. And I think that might be part of, or at least one of the messages of the film. I mean, I wanted to ask you this. What do you think that the title is about, Rob Kelly?
Well, I mean, it's as is usual with Bob. He's always talking about people's appearances, people giving people's saying one thing and thinking another, or being one thing and being another. I mean, good, you know, he does that on the screenplay credit. He's not credited. It's Sergei Petrov and Rene Fontaine, which are pseudonyms for Bob and Larry Charles.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a Jack Frost, you know, he, for some reason, he seems to find some value in that of assuming a fake name when everyone knows who he is, but there's something about that. But yeah, I mean, nobody in the movie is exactly who they claim to be. Not in a literal sense, but everyone is sort of presenting themselves as something slightly different than they are. I mean, but then again, it also bleeds through. I mean, John Goodman's character is this big jovial guy, but you know, he's, you know, maybe not a criminal, but he certainly will rob you blind if you turn your back on him and stuff like that. And Nina Veronica, the Jessica Lange character. And you talk about Val Kilmer with the thing with the bunny rabbit. You talked about the music. Before I forget about that, the music is terrific, right? I actually love every performance. The Down in the Flood, I think is great. It was nice to hear him sing some of the more obscure songs. I mean, again, something from Empire Burlesque. Oh, that's one of the TV shows on the board too, is Empire Burlesque, which would be a great TV show.
I'd watch that. Yeah.
Oh, I totally watched that. I will admit, I think, and it has always probably colored my view of it. And it's funny. I forget if what episode we were talking about. Oh no, it actually might have been our episode. We were talking about Budokan. And the reviews of it were so negative, and people were like, why is he wasting his time with this? And I was sort of like, geez, what was everybody so cranky about? I mean, Bob gives you what he wants to give you. You just be happy with it and judge it on its own merits. But I have to admit, you know, cut to 2003, and I hear about this movie, and Bob had put out Love and Theft in 2001. This was just before he would start going many, many years in between records. Right. We learned to live with that in the 21st century, that he would go 5, 6, 7 years in between records. But at that point, that hadn't really been the case. And so I was like, well, he did Time in a Mind in 97 and then Love and Theft in 2001. So he must be working on another record. Right. And they're like, no, he's making a movie. And I was like, why? Why is he wasting his time making a movie? And then I thought, well, OK, that means we're going to get an all new soundtrack record. Right? It's Bob Dylan in a movie. I mean, clearly it's going to be a soundtrack with 10 new original Bob Dylan songs. And they're like, no, it's all covers of his own songs. I'm like, oh, all right. And then some of them are not even him covering it. I was like, oh, you know, it just felt like, really? This is not, you know, and so, and that's not fair to him to judge it on that standard. But no. I can remember just being like, oh, all right, we're going to get him singing I Remember You. All right. Well, I guess that's okay. You know, like it just
and that's
like,
not even on the soundtrack album.
No. Like, you know, I'm like, okay. It just felt like this is what he's spending his time on? Is this thing? And I think maybe that has permanently colored my view of it. But I mean, in terms of the title, I mean, what's your view? What do you think Mastered Anonymous means?
Well,
if it means anything.
On. I'll get to that in a second, because you mentioned the reviews, and I went through a bunch of them. Mm. Here are some of the choice bits. Incoherent and uninteresting. Pretentious navel-gazing. Insufferable. The enormous cast wanders bewildered through shapeless scenes. It's a vanity production beyond all reason. Incoherent, raving, juvenile meanderings. That's a good one. An unholy mess of frantic, swirling, hysterically overplotted post-apocalyptic social parable that dances around the energy-sucking black hole of Dylan's nearly comatose hero. Wow. Bloated by self-regard, a self-important, absurdist joke of a film. And then, my favorite, a strong contender for the worst movie of the century. Calm right. down. Yeah.
All right, everybody. Okay. It's interesting that stuff gets pegged on people like Vanity Project. I guess, but it's like, well, okay. I mean, what, like Martin Scorsese appears as himself essentially at the end of Killers of the Flower Moon. Is that a vanity? Orson Welles directed and starred in Citizen Kane. Is that vanity? Like, well, why, if you are the star of the movie that you've brought forth, is it inherently a vanity project? You know,
right?
I don't know.
Especially when the character you're playing is washed up, insulted at every turn, slapped around, jailed, and then jailed again. Doesn't even get to do anything. In fact, that's one of the interesting things about it, I think, is that the Jack Fate doesn't do anything except play music, right? Everything happens to him.
Yeah, he just wanders around. He ain't talking it, you know? He's just kind of wandering around looking at things.
You know, he doesn't break out of jail. That would be a vanity project if Jack Fate, you know, had an exciting breakout scene. He punches out a couple guards and leaps the wall and so on.
Well, right? We know that Bob Dylan is completely incapable of throwing a punch, we know. And by the way, in this movie, he pushes Jeff Bridges, which is completely unconvincing. I wish they would stop making Bob do physical things like that, because it looks like he cannot. When he pushes Jeff Bridges, I'm like, Jeff Bridges would barely go back on his heels at the force of little 5'7 Bob Dylan.
And he 80 looks
pound Bob Dylan,
tiny and frail. And, you know, that pushes, you're not only unconvincing, it's kind of sad, because he looks frightened in a way, you know. And that scene has always sort of bothered me, because it doesn't look right at all. But Yeah, just that the character, everything happens to him. He's moved around, plays, all he does is play a couple songs. I think that's probably one of the messages, right? You know, all I do is play music. I'm a song and dance man. You know, don't, a lot of the other things, again, the overblown interview scene and so on, don't go to him for answers. He doesn't have any, he just plays songs, right? He might have a few left, as he says at one point, right? Like, you're not going to try anything, are you? Says the god. No, I've got a lot of respect for a man with a gun. Yeah, he just sort of wanders around, talks to people, tries to avoid trouble as much as possible, plays a couple songs, and then gets thrown back in jail. So I think for me, that might have to do with the Mastin Anonymous, that life is menacing and dangerous, and everybody around you is going to try to take something from you or tell you what to do. Well, that whole bit with the, you know, where the Jessica Lange character is saying, did you explain to him the limitations, the rules? And
she's great in this movie.
Yeah, she's terrific.
She's really great.
No, all of the performances are great.
Vampire, you know, she's great.
Yeah, with her cigarettes and yeah.
Yeah.
That it is, it's a menacing, the world is a menacing place. And the only way you're going to get through it is by non-involvement with other people's craziness. And the only way to do that is to be masked and anonymous, right? That's maybe the only way to stay safe. And then to try to hang that on this sort of washed up superstar that nobody seems to particularly like, but he's still held in some reverence anyway, right? Like, doesn't Veronica say at one point he doesn't do anything? You know, he doesn't go on tour. He doesn't make albums. He doesn't do anything. But then when they're sitting lounging around on the set or whatever, and that woman with an enormous cast on her arm, which is not explained, brings her daughter out and says, you know, she's memorized all of your songs.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck faces. Mm-hmm. Why did she do that? Well, because I made her. Right. So
that's ominous.
Yeah. And again, sort of menacing and weird. Right. And he's just sitting there with the band. And then, again, not only does he not do anything, he gets framed in the end for a murder he didn't commit, right? It's Bobby Cupid that stabs Tom Friend in the neck with, was it Blind Lemon's guitar? Is that what it was? Yeah. Another scene that bothers me, because I know Tom Friend is supposed to be, you know, the media and intrusive and a jerk and so on. But then, what did Penelope Cruz's character do wrong? You know, she's then sort of weeping over the body. I thought, oh, dear. I liked her. This is not.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bobby Cupid just goes, I'll go out the back way. And then the cops come and grab Dylan and throw him in the van. And then as he's right being driven off to execution or back to jail or whatever, he's almost smiling, right? And that's the bit where he goes, I stopped trying to figure things out a long time ago, which is one of those sort of, it undercuts the whole film to a certain extent, right? Like, maybe this is what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, all this weird stuff. Line. Just, yeah. This,
like, it's that season of Dallas where it was all just a dream, right? Yeah. Don't worry about it. So that's a Dallas reference for the kids, you know?
Yeah, right. Kids. Yeah. Kids love that. Yeah. Yeah. That is true. That line, first of all, there's large chunks of Bob that is narrated by him over footage of him, and that to me, that's always smacks of post-production, of where they realize, you know, they got the footage back and they realize, oh shit, no, we have no idea what's happening in this movie, so Bob, come in and narrate your thoughts, you know. There's yes. a little bit of that, you know. I feel like it's the whispering in Dune, you know. It's like, watch out, I don't know, put my hand in the box, you know. It's just like, well, you know, I will say this for the movie, and in my, you know, and I mean this genuinely, it's alive. It's an alive piece. One of the things that I think can happen to people that achieve his level of fame, and I think he himself has guarded against this his whole career, is when you reach that level of success, you have nothing but a team of handlers around you who are trying to make sure that you do the right thing at every turn. And that can end up meaning that you end up appearing or doing projects that are the most safe, bland thing imaginable to appeal to the fan base you've already got. I don't want to alienate anybody. And that is something Bob clearly has never done. It's something it's, and I will say, as much as the show here has always been focused on his work, one of the most inspiring things I take from my fandom of him is how he has seemingly managed his the artist side of his life, is that he just tries new things constantly. He gives up. He will even give up things that seem to be working, you know, to move on, just to be moving on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that to be very inspiring. And he's still doing it. And so, you know, a star at his level, if he had been put in a movie at 73 years old, you can imagine it being just a piece of forgettable fluff that just, you know, you're like, well, why did, what, you know, how did he get roped into that? I'll give Mastin Anonymous credit. No other person at his level would make something as weird as this, you know, and that, yeah. And that he deserves all the credit in the world for putting himself in such a strange situation where the risk of failure is so high. And then, you know, you read all those reviews. Most people said it was a failure. But it certainly is. It's an alive piece. It lives and it breathes, maybe on its own terms, and you can argue whether it works or it doesn't, but it's present. And I do appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like all the best art. It's, you're right. It's not tired. It's just weird enough to get through, to sneak through, I think. Yeah. I watch it from time to time, but I've seen it enough. Then I just, some of the lines, like, for you, maybe. I say that to my kids all the time, right? Dada, is it okay? Is it bedtime? For you, maybe. I haven't had any chance to say Rabbit must have done something, but I keep waiting for
someday. It's going to come up and it's going to be glorious.
Yeah, no, I do think it's a mess, and I don't think it really works. And as you said before, you know, if you're not a Bob Dylan fan, it's probably excruciating, you know, to sit through it. But I don't care. I am.
But we are, right. If it's for us, we are. So, okay, that's fine. Yeah. Like I said, I've seen it now. I think I've seen this movie probably 4 or 5 times, and it will work to different degrees depending on when I'm seeing it. It might just be the mood I'm in. It might just be, you know, I don't know. Like I said, the stuff, the light, like you quoted, when he gets on the bus, is this bus going over the border? No, man, you're going the wrong way. Okay. Like that is hilarious. Like that is hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, like, and you can't explain to somebody why that's funny. It either is to them or it isn't. And there's no, you know, there's no point in saying, oh no, it's funny. And so when I get into that level, and like I said, like the TV shows, like all that is really great. And the music footage is terrific. It's so wonderful seeing the band, the guys like that, just up close. You know, the part of them where they're sitting on the stage and they're all kind of crouched down. They always have that look of like they're a slightly seedy, you know, gang of toughs. And I love that. I almost wish the band had been given a little more to do. And, you know, John Goodman bringing on all the people in the coming into the trailer, you know, Abraham
Eddie
Lincoln.
Quicksand, another great name. Eddie Quicksand with Milo, you know, that's the,
you know, yeah, you know, John Darm, the, you know, the, this
John,
that.
John Darkness, yeah,
John Darkness, you know, I mean, like that shit's hysterical, you know, like that, all that is really.
And then the shooting gallery of world figures, that's what he calls them, right? Gandhi, the Pope, and Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. I love the framing of when we first see Uncle Sweetheart, where the two guys that are there to get money from him, and they're just these black shapes, these silhouettes,
and
Uncle Sweetheart's just right in the center, you know, like that.
Shut
great.
Up! I stop talking. I can't, because that's the only way I know I'm still alive. Yeah. Which is another great line. Yeah.
Oh, I also love Ed Harris in this as the sort of ghostly figure of like the sort
in
of the minstrel
face. Yeah.
In blackface.
Yeah. What do you make of that scene?
Well, I mean, I actually really like that scene because Ed Harris is a terrific actor. He's another guy who I feel is always very alive when he's in a movie. Like he's never phoning it in. And I think that scene has got, I like the, that, okay, this ghostly figure from the past is now sitting there and is present and is talking to Jack Fate and him conjuring up all of kind of, you know, U.S. history and the original sin of America and things like that. I thought all that stuff is terrific. I'm glad that, you know, this movie didn't get just completely thrown out as, well, it's got blackface in it. It's offensive. It's like, well, it's context, you know, it's context. No, I think he's great in that one scene, you know, of course he has that great voice, the wonderfully deep, kind of baritone voice. But no, all that stuff is great. Like I said, any, as you said, every, any individual scene is not bad. The stuff with Val Kilmer is interesting and all that stuff, but it's just, yeah, it just does not hang together. And that to me is why it's, I love the music. The music always, almost always hangs together for me. And as the movie, not so much. So,
especially you just mentioned that the original, or America's original scene, that bit where Jack Fade is on the bus and
Giovanni Ribisi.
No, no. When he's, it's after he's been hauled off and, well, after he jumps off to confront the, remember, it's just when the bus is pulling into the city and it's, Larry Charles said, we just shot that. That's none of this. Those are sets or actors. All the homeless people and so on the streets. He said, that's downtown LA. I just got on the bus and shot it. And it's playing, what's the song that comes on? No One Sings the Blues Like
Blind Willie McTell.
That's a brilliant use of music at that part. Just fits. And again, we talked a bit about the music. You didn't say much about the, like the Japanese version of My Back Pages that kicks the movie off.
Yeah.
Also the Italian version, that sort of semi-rap version of
Like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah. What do you think of those?
They're certainly very interesting, and they certainly underscore the, you know, Bob's sort of universal appeal that you can transmute this stuff to that different level. I mean, you know, I enjoyed it. It was fun hearing it. It's Jack Fate, the Bob Dylan that we know, that we're dealing with in the world that we all live in, that we're seeing this movie in, is so different from the Jack Fate in the movie. You know, like, he doesn't seem like that renowned a figure. So I don't quite get, it's like, yeah, we've got all these different people, the Little Black Girl singing, you know,
Times Are Changing.
It's like, are these people really that inspired by Jack Fate? Really? It's like they're talking, those covers are Bob Dylan, but he's not playing Bob Dylan in the movie. He's playing a guy who, it's just, to me, there's a disconnect there that just doesn't quite.
It's a bit messy, but I sort of thought of those, having those different songs in different languages and so on, maybe tied in with the Ed Harris scene, sort of as another undercurrent that, and this is another menace for the artist, the changing tastes, right? What is perfectly acceptable and interesting and entertaining for one generation becomes, you know, it changes each time. You can't do blackface anymore, or Jack Fate is not popular anymore, or, you know, the artists are they're not, victimized is not the right word, but they are vulnerable to changing tastes, right? Whether you're popular or not popular, you're acceptable, you're not acceptable, and your art is not, you're not, you might have made it, you might have written these songs and so on, but they don't belong to you anymore, right? The minute you put them out, they're slippery. They change languages. They're in favor, they're out of favor. They go all over the place, and you can't control that. You know, that's another reason you need to protect yourself, you know, or the more anonymous you can be, maybe the better, because you're going to be out of favor at some point, and they'll come after you, and they'll throw you in the bear cage at the LA Zoo, right? If you're not careful. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. Yeah. It's sort of like you said, the longest Bob Dylan song is going to be 20 minutes. Most of them are not, you know, they're three.
Most of them are right. That's an outlier. Yeah.
You can handle sort of that ambiguity and weirdness for 3 or 4 minutes or whatever, you know, aren't most of the songs on John Wesley Harding sort of 3 minutes or 3 and a half
minutes?
Oh,
yeah. Like 220, 230. Yeah, that's short.
And they're mysterious and weird, but, you know, that's in doses like that, you can handle it. But yeah. What is this, an hour and 40 minutes or whatever?
It's like 149, I think, something
149.
Like that.
Yeah, that's a lot of jumbled ambiguity and baloney to handle all at once, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And that's it. That's why it's – and it's hard because, you said, you've got Bob in the center of it who just is – he doesn't – you're not leaning in on him at all. He's just – he's keeping you at a distance because that's who he is. He just doesn't – and that's, you know, that the downside to having him in your movie. I mean, could this have been something where Bob was not even in the movie, where he wrote it and then got someone else to play him, and someone else that was a little more of a
who would you cast?
Yeah, that's
for that?
That's a really interesting thought of, like,
to be Jack Fate in a movie written by Dylan, right?
Well, I wish I had thought about that early. I wish I thought that question earlier. I would have liked to have pondered that. Like, what that? Yeah. I mean, I think this thing was always going to star Bob. That was his inclination. Yeah. I mean, look, the guy wanted to be a movie star. I mean, it's a thing that happens to all musicians to some when you get to a certain level. And it makes sense. You know, yeah. You're on stage and you're commanding an audience. It makes sense to think, well, you can be in movies too. Why not?
But that's always interested me and appalled me very often too. This weird thing that great successes in one art form, they just can't help themselves. And they have to, yep. if you're a movie star, you have to be a rock star too, right? Johnny Depp or... and vice versa, you know,
yeah.
and you also have to write a book and you have to be a poet and, you know, you want all of the, Paul Stanley is a painter too, right? Mm. He claims, this is Paul Stanley of Kiss, by the way, he's the star mm-hmm. child. He claims to have sold more than $20 million worth of paintings, right? Mm. That's what he claims. It may be true. I don't know, but I've seen his paintings and I have my doubts, you know, but yet it's like nobody is ever satisfied with the one thing that they're sort of renowned for. And they want those other accolades or something, right? Dylan writing there's Tarantula, which nobody seems to like, but Chronicles is terrific. And so is mm-hmm. the Philosophy of Modern Song. Okay. But yeah, he also wants to be a movie star. Everybody wants to be a movie. You probably want to be a movie star, Rob. Do you? No,
not at all. Not even a little.
I would cast you as Jack Fate.
That would be a horrendous. You want to see a block of wood on screen? But throw me up there. No. I would love to be behind the camera working in that context, but never on screen. Not even. I have zero desire. Even though I choose to record podcasts and put myself out there in this form.
Yeah,
that no one is asking for. I'm choosing to do it. That this is the limits of my ambition when it comes to that kind of thing. So,
well, that reminds me. I meant to mention this earlier, but I once saw an interview with Martin Scorsese, where I forget which did he direct Quiz Show?
No,
oh, he was he in Quiz Show. Was it?
He's in Quiz Show. Yes, yes, he is in it. Yeah,
that's what he was. Just in this interview, he said, okay, you know, I'm always telling my actors what to do and giving them shit and so on. And then when I was doing my little scene in Quiz Show, I had to walk across the set. And the director said, cut, you know, what are you doing, Marty? Why are you walking like that? He said, what do you mean? He said, why are you walking? It's so weird. And he said, I couldn't walk normally. Like, you know, behind the camera, I know. But suddenly everything was totally different. And that's sort mm-hmm. of what Dylan looks like in this movie, right? Except mm-hmm. nobody said Nobody, Larry Charles just didn't have the balls to say, cut, no, Bob, nobody phones somebody like that. Nobody sits on the windowsill.
No one sits in a chair like this. Like no human, yeah, yeah.
That whole bit where he checks into the hotel.
Oh, that again, is, yeah, Tracy Walter great, is the desk clerk, yeah.
It's another great scene, right? Will you be requiring a woman? What kind of woman? We got all kinds.
We got all kinds of women. We got tall women, short women.
Short women.
Exotic
women. Intellectual women. Yeah. Runs the gamut.
I love that he gives him Nixon's old room. Yeah. And it's the shittiest, like I don't think Nixon stayed.
Well, that's another line that I've got in the back of my mind that I can't wait to, you know, I think I stayed here once before, right?
Yeah.
Look around hotel lobbies. I think I stayed here before.
Now that's got to be a line from Bob's real life, right? When you've toured as much as him, that's got to be something where he's like, have we been here before? Maybe. I mean, the man's been touring for 60 years. He's probably stayed at every hotel that there is available to stay in.
But that whole scene, just his weird slouch into the lobby, there's on Larry Charles on the commentary track, because there's a statue that's been wrapped in canvas or something, right? That Bob looks at, you know, someone's clearly off screen going, look at the statue, Bob. Mm. But it was apparently of the Thinker. And Larry Charles says, we didn't get clearance to show it in the, we couldn't use it. So then somebody had the idea to wrap it up as if all art is being covered, you know, or.
Oh, that's fun. Oh, wow. I didn't even. Think about
right,
that.
Because if you blink, you'll miss it, right? Just
mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, maybe that's another thing that they're talking about, that, you know, art is under threat all, especially in a dictatorship, because that's what happens at the end, right? When Mickey Rourke takes over and says, you know, we're erasing collective memory and there will be no more stupidity. And then he just throws the podium aside and says, God help you all. Yeah. In fact, okay, we can get to how prescient this movie may or may not be in a second, but that whole scene, yeah, in the motel as he checks in, and you know that then it gets a bit ponderous, like, oh, your pen is still out of ink.
Yes,
I like that, but then, sir, your pen, it's full. I thought, oh, okay, that's a bit much. But then, yeah, then he checks into this room, and then he pauses and well, there's. I've never seen, again, he doesn't know how to close a door. I don't know if you noticed that when he turns around and closes the door. Very stiff and awkward. But then he sort of pauses and the camera is in the closet, like, and look, filming him from inside the closet as he stops and looks at the closet. And then there's that weird subplot where, because he's the son of the dictator, right? Mm-hmm. Who is dying.
It's all the, everything becomes monochromatic at that point.
Who is dying on stage, right? That's the... in the Mickey Rourke compound there. He's actually on a stage, the dictator, behind curtains. But then there's that flashback sequence where he was, the dictator was having an affair with what is the actress's name?
Angela Bassett.
Yeah. And then, so does young Bob. That seems to be what happens, right?
Yes.
It's never clear who's hiding in the closet, because during that scene where the goons bust in on young Bob and the mistress, somebody is filming or looking from inside the closet. Did you notice that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's but, I'm just find it like, okay, I'm not sure what's happening here.
Yeah, okay. And then because they throw him down the stairs, right? And then there's also that weird connected bit later where he goes to visit her again, right? And he crashes his car. Right. You know, he drives off in Bobby Cupid's car and then you see it. It's crashed. And he's clearly hit his head on the windshield. And then he pauses in the cemetery and they're playing that spooky version of was it One More Cup of Coffee or something?
I think it is. Yeah.
And then he goes to visit her again. Right. That bit. And she says, what can I do for you? And he that was a bad night. He says, what? Yeah. Okay. None of that makes any sense. But why did I get onto this? Do you remember? I don't remember. This movie is scrambled. This movie has jangled my brains, Rob. Trying to talk about it. But,
well, you wondered about it being prescient, perhaps prescient. Oh,
okay, but yes, that kind of it. I don't think it's prescient. I don't think it's predicting anything. But it was when I was watching it the other day. It was hard to avoid thinking of Trump and the chaos of the current political situation in America now. And that bit of Mickey Rourke's at the end, I thought, ooh, that doesn't sound as crazy now as it did in 2003. Actually, this sounds like part of what we're hearing all the
time. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, Mickey Rourke is playing a guy who we are dealing with now. And I don't mean a specific person. Unfortunately, there's lots of these people that are just, they're kind of like, they're pulling the mask off a little and sort of being like, I'm your leader. I'm going to treat you like shit and you know it. And I'm not going to bother to pretend otherwise. And some people could argue, well, that's good because they're not lying anymore. But then there's other, you could also argue, yeah, but here's someone who's we've even given up the very notion of trying anymore. Of just, you know, like, I'm just going to be horrible. And that's what we're dealing with now, is that there's a lot of people out there that are like, I'm horrible. I'm going to continue to be horrible. And that's, you know, I'm not even, I don't even respect you enough to even pretend anymore. So I'm just going to be a nightmare. And that is Mickey Rourke is definitely playing somebody that.
Yeah.
I think
and he
nowadays,
walks up with a speech, right? And he crumples up the speech and just tosses it and then grips the podium and says, okay.
Right. And then unfortunately there are something like half the voting populace in this country that are like, that means he tells it like it is. And it's like, that's not what that is at all. That's not what that means. But unfortunately so that it is sort of prescient in that view, in that weird just mixture of like, I'm an entertainer, but I'm also your leader. And you're like, well, these two things are not meant to blend together. So, you know, that I could, yes, some of it. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I when I listen to you talk about it, I like it a lot more. When I sit and watch it by myself, I just no. Okay, all right, you know, they're gonna play again. That's cool. Like he's gonna do. All right,
well,
that's awesome.
When we finally meet face to face, Rob Kelly, one of the things we'll have to make time for is we'll make an hour and 47 minutes worth of time to sit down and watch this amongst all our other adventures. Okay,
fair enough. That's okay. Fair. We'll do that. Yeah. We'll send the wives off to go do something fun while you and I punish each other. So you watch Mr. Anonymous.
What? Yeah. No, they'll have fun. But
yeah, exactly. You do go have fun. We're gonna sit here like idiots and watch this Mr. Anonymous. God sakes.
What happened to you? What happened to me? How far back you want to go? Yeah.
Jason, we've talked about this. Do you have anything else you want to say about Missing Anonymous? I hate to wrap the show up because we know we won't be doing this again for maybe, you know, but anything else you want to say about the movie before we sign off?
Well, not really, but I'm just glad it exists. It's
sure. Like, oh, absolutely.
You know, and I do find nooks and crannies of, you know, my favorite artists' careers really interesting. And sometimes the flops are even more interesting than the successes. Not always, but sometimes. Again, even the Beatles couldn't make a proper movie on their own, right?
Well,
have you ever seen Magical Mystery Tour? Have you ever
when you added the on their own. Okay.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, A Hard Day's Night, certainly.
Well, again,
one of the great films ever made.
Yes. Yeah,
but that wasn't them,
help
right?
A lot too. Yeah, but that's written by somebody else and directed by somebody else. And then
they had an actual real director directing, Richard Lester in that case. So yeah.
And then they thought, okay, this, you know, again, this kind of conceit that seems to come over rock stars. They go, okay, I've been in a successful movie. I was paying attention. I see how they do it. No problem. And then they discover that it's a very big problem. Have you ever sat through Magical Mystery Tour?
I think so. I probably at some point.
I adore the Beatles, but I can't sit through that whole movie, and it's it's less than an hour long, and I just can't stand it. The music is great. Again, same thing with the Prince movies. The musical sequences are terrific. You know, it's just the rest of the stuff. You know, their reach. What is it? The reach and grasp, etc.
The reach exceeds their grasp. Yeah.
Yes, by a long shot. But again, I do watch this from time to time. I find parts of it really, really funny. Just to see Bob being so weird and willing to be seen as so weird. That's great.
Yes. You know? And of course, it's great that it exists because we tend to view things, or at least some people, as kind of like, well, if he hadn't done this movie, we would have gotten two more Bob Dylan albums. Well, that we don't know that. You know what I mean? It's like, we don't like, it's, I've heard kind of a similar argument about people that are not fans of the Avatar movies. And they say, well, it sucks that this great director, James Cameron, is going to spend the rest of his career making Avatar movies when he could be making other movies that I'd be more interested in seeing. Well, that's assuming something that may not be true. It could be that James Cameron is like, I want to make Avatar movies. And if I can't, I don't want to make movies anymore. So you might not be getting anything. So, I mean, you know, so yeah, in maybe if Bob had never done Masked and Anonymous, he would have done nothing. He would have, you know, he just would have, as you mentioned, the movie only took 3 weeks to shoot. It wasn't like it was a giant, you know, it wasn't Cleopatra. It didn't take him 2.5 years to make. So you say, well, okay, if he hadn't made this movie, he might have not done anything and there just might have been nothing. Well, okay. Well, then I'd rather have the movie then, because at least it's something to analyze and have fun with here and there. So yeah, you know, of course, always happy. Even when he puts out a record that's lesser than, I'm still glad it exists because it's like better than it not existing at all. I mean, I don't love the Sinatra records, but I'm glad they exist because there's still some other people enjoy them and there's things for me to enjoy better than nothing. So yeah, I'm glad Bastard Anonymous is out there and every so often I can revisit it. And like I said, when we eventually come to Japan, we'll sit and watch the movie together.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And the ladies can go out for sushi and you and I will sit here in this very room and watch Mastin and Anonymous. It's gonna
that
be
sounds like it. A sounds like a fun afternoon. Well, why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Okay, well, I'd like for people to find me on my podcast, which is called Writers Read Their Early Shit. And you can, you know, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find it. Comes out every 3 weeks or so. And I talk to mostly writers, but also artists of all kinds, including Rob Kelly, about their early efforts and creativity and so on and so forth. So that would be terrific. Other than that, well, that's sort of, yeah, I'm
that's
around.
Good enough. You don't need to have more than that. See, you know, why do you need to be do multiple things, Jason? Just be good at that. What are you doing? You don't have to just be good at podcasting. We don't have to be in a movie.
Yeah, thank you. But I have been in movies. Actually, when my brother moved to Japan on his first day, because we made a couple amateur movies when we were in Canada together. And then on his first day in Japan, he said, let's make a movie. And I said, oh, yeah? And he said, yeah, like we used to. I said, okay, about what? And he said, about Kiss, of course. So we made a 90-minute amateur movie about Kiss, well, about four foreigners in Japan who start a Kiss tribute band. And yes, so we had to, you know, you're right. I'm guilty of the same thing. I can't just be a great writer and a great podcaster and a great husband and a great father. I also had to be
it's so funny. I feel it's so funny that people feel the need to be like, oh, is there more? No, there's one thing is enough. It's fine. It's really okay. You don't need to do a lot more. So, well, look, I will say this on air for everyone to listen. I've mentioned this previous episodes. One of the great benefits to me doing the show and putting the effort that I put into it was that I got to become friends with a lot of different people, and I got to talk to people that I would never get to talk to. One of the great things about this is this format. It's the triumph over geography, because Jason, you're in Japan. When you and I ever cross paths, but now we've gotten to do this. And I will say to everybody who's listening to this, Jason has been a great friend to the show. As you all know, he's been on multiple times, but he's been a great friend to me in real life as well. And I really, one of the great benefits to having ever done the show is getting to call Jason my friend. And I will, the show is, if we're nothing else, the show is worth it for that. And so I deeply appreciate your friendship, and we will do. I've been on your show. We talked about you coming on my movie show, Fade Out, at some point. We will do that because I just cannot. You send me these wonderful postcards from Japan, which are just fantastic. By the way, my wife has to read them to me because your writing is so small and the pen nib you use is so slight that I can't read it anymore. So she has to read it to me like I'm an invalid. But nevertheless, I keep them all in a box here next to me as all your postcards that you sent. But anyway, you've been a terrific friend, and we will continue to have conversations, just not on air, about Bob Dylan going forward. So thank you for all the appearances you've done. Every episode you've ever done, Jason, is the kind of show that I wish the show had been on more regular occasions, I will say. As a podcaster, you know this. Sometimes you come away from a show and it's either the guest or you don't have a rhythm with the guest, or there's other external things, and you just kind of go, well, that wasn't great, but it's got to come out. What are you going to do? I'm not going to throw it out. So, okay. Oftentimes Bob Dylan was like that. Again, no fault to the guest, mostly had to do with me and things like that. But every episode with you has always been the kind of thing where I say, this is what I want the show to be. And wow. So I really appreciate all the appearances and all the friendship you've shown me. So thank you very much, my friend.
Thank you very much. And thank you for all the time and work you've put into this podcast. I know how much time it takes and how disappointing it can be sometimes and how difficult. And for me, Rob, it's, you know, I was a fan long before I contacted you, and to have you know, you were this voice, you know, just a voice in space. And then to get to be on the show and become friends with you, it's just been a great pleasure. So thank you very much for the show. Thank you for your hard work. And I mean, it's bittersweet that we're never going to get to Ugliest Girl in the World or They Killed Him. You know, I was hoping one day. Maybe, again, you never know. right? You never know.
Okay, I'll say this. I'll mention this on the last episode when we get to it. Oh, by the way, everybody, I actually asked Jason to be my guest on the last episode. He turned me down. So if you end up not liking the last episode, blame him. But I will say this. It's a podcast, everybody. It's not like it's a TV show where when you get canceled, they demolish the sets, you know, and it's kind of hard to bring it back or whatever. I'm part of the reason the show is ending is because my life is changing in a way that I want to have time to go try other things. And producing a weekly show was just, you know, the scheduling and the booking and the recording and the editing and the posting, all that. And it just was, that thing was not conducive to that, but my life might change again. In fact, I hope it does. I mean, I hope that the life that I start taking on in a couple of months isn't my final form. I hope I keep heating up busy being born, busy dying. Yeah. So maybe my life will change again. And I will say, you know what? I have room for this again. And I miss it. Or more likely Bob will drop a new record the week after I end the show or something, or they will finally do the Street Legal sessions for the bootleg series. And there will there will be something that I will just be so dying to comment on. And I will feel like I will need my forum, that Pod Dylan could come back in some sort of regular form or an irregular form. It's a podcast. It can always, I've had other shows that I have ended, and then I've come back and brought back for one episode here and there for here and there. So, yes, the show is ending in its current form on April 13th, but you never know. You never know. And so, you know, Jason, you and I might get to do Ugliest Girl in the World at some point. We don't know.
I could just see you sitting bolt upright in bed, you know, jerking upright and going, oh, I have to do it. I can't leave it undone. Yeah.
All they right. killed and him. I'll, we got to talk. They killed him.
I'll be ready, waiting for the call, man.
Outstanding.
Yeah, no, it's going to be great. Well, thanks again, man. It's been a great show, and I've listened to, I think every single episode. How many are there?
Well, by the time this the last one will be 315 when we get to it.
Yeah, and it's really helped me to. You know, I often go back and listen to the song in a different way, or sometimes for the first time. It's been helpful and useful and entertaining and great. So cheers, man.
Thank you very much. So, and thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find the show on Twitter and on Blue Sky as Pod Dylan. And if you want to access the first 100 shows, you can subscribe to the show or on fmpods.com. But all the rest of the episodes will remain on fmpods.com for your perusal. And the show will remain on all the various podcast platforms it can be found on. So that is going to do it. Thank you all for listening. And we will see you next week. Bye.
This bus going across the border?
No, sir. You're going the wrong way.
All right.